Well, good afternoon. We'll get started here. Why don't we start with a review? I'm kind of in my teaching mode right now. We were on page 28 yesterday. So what did you write down, that those that were here, what did you write down for your key takeaway?
Rhythm.
Get in rhythm. Get in sync. All right. Now, I'm afraid to do this, but I've already tested a little bit with a few people. How did you sleep last night? Sleep all right? Did any of that information help you? Okay. Getting it dark? Did you get dark enough in your windows and you put a bag over your head? A coat over her head. Okay. That was not my suggestion. She did that on her own. Back here. All right. So today we're going to turn to page 40. Now, what do you think about these booklets? I had lunch with one of the people that were instrumental in putting this together. This is phenomenal, isn't it? Isn't this cool? I think this is great. One per family. One per person. Better go to the booth and get another one. They might have one for you. Okay, I want to get some feedback. I had this logo designed about 14 years ago. And what it is, it's like what Ty was saying, is how we cannot really separate. You know, so many times we separate health from spiritual aspects. And what this is supposed to represent is that we're a composite human being that the Spirit dwells in. Okay, give me some feedback on the logo. Does that kind of resonate with you a little bit? 14 years ago, I was accused of being New Age when I had that designed. Does that look New Age, or are we just kind of getting desensitized? The wreath, I'm not sure. Yeah, that's a good point. It's a victory wreath. It's Nike, the goddess of victory. That's what Nike means, you know? Did you know that, what Nike means? It's a Greek word for victory. There you go. It's worth the price of admission. Okay, we're going to talk about the age of nutritionism. How many have heard the word nutritionism? Have you heard the word? Where have you heard it? You see it on the internet and so forth like that? This RD down here, this, it lets you know that I'm a registered dietitian. Okay, but I'm not your typical in-the-box dietitian. Are there any dietitians in the group? Any other dietitians? Okay, what we're going to look at today is, this is my passion. This is what I started out studying. Even before I became a Christian, I was studying nutrition. So this is my number one passion as far as the health aspect goes. Now, most of you probably already have more nutrition knowledge than most of my students do, even when they graduate. Several of you are health educators and things like that. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to try to give you some tools so you can share it with somebody else. And what we're going to do is, we're going to go through, how can you look at and understand and apply all the nutrition information that comes at us like out of a fire hose? Isn't that the way you feel right now? We're in the age of nutritionism. So I'm going to explain what that is. But what I'm trying to do, and the philosophy that I teach from and everything I do, is that we need to cooperate with the way the body was intended to operate. Does that make sense?
Yes.
The body's been designed to operate in a specific mode, but what we do with our lifestyles is we force our bodies to function in ways it was never meant to function. And if we line up our will with God's will and the way the body was meant to operate, we will have greater longevity, health, lower blood pressure, lower cholesterol, all those things will fall in line. And we don't have to sit there with our checklist and check off. You can still get lab reports, but we don't have to sit there and check off that we're getting our lab values right in line, because they will fall in line. Somebody was just talking to me about a CHIP program over here. We have some friends that just did their first CHIP program back in a church that we attended, that we were members of for 7 years, had health meetings and stuff like that. We moved away, and they got excited and started doing CHIP programs. Sometimes we got to get out of the way so other people can do stuff. But while we were there, people wouldn't do anything. But we left, and they actually did a CHIP program. And one of the individuals there, very active person, been on blood pressure medication and not regulated. Okay, goes through a 3-week CHIP program off all his meds. See, he got in line. He cooperated with the way the body was intended to operate. So hopefully what I'm intending to do here is to put the, you know, the paddles on you and jolt you a little bit maybe, and then so you can share it with people in your community and your family. So let's take a look at what I'm going to kind of give you a little history lesson wrapped up in with what these principles we can do to actually cooperate as far as nutrition goes. I go back to 1986 when I was attending the North Dakota State University, the Bison. Okay, we had the Thundering Herd there in North Dakota. 30 below, playing hockey at the college level, and I'm looking at the course schedule to try to find a class that fits my schedule. Right? Okay. I was going to be a game warden first, then I was going to be a landscape architect, and then I don't know what I was doing at the time. So I was looking through the catalog, and I saw this class listed called Nutrition for Fitness. Okay, and I'm thinking, what time of day is that? Okay, I've got hockey practice here, I've got to lift weights here. Where does it fit? So it fit my schedule, and I said, well, I'll take this Nutrition for Fitness thinking maybe it can enhance my hockey skills. Maybe I can crash people into the boards harder. Maybe I can, you know, take them out. And then I decided I would take this other class along with it, kind of a sister class called Food Selection and Preparation. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. The only nutrition information I had at that point was what was on the side of my Pop-Tart box. I thought, seriously, you know, you sit there and you're eating and you're reading the Cheerios and all that stuff, and it back then, we didn't have nutritionism. And I'll share with you what that means. So I took these classes. By the end of this quarter, we were on a quarter system. By the end of that quarter, I decided to quit playing hockey. I knew I wasn't going to make any money playing hockey. Okay? So I decided I'm going to quit hockey and study nutrition and take off with that. Well, one thing led to the next, and we started studying nutrition. And did you know that back in 1894 was the first year that the USDA put out some guidelines on how we should eat? Okay, you've heard of the name of Wilbur Atwater. Does that mean anything to you? Okay, you don't need to know that. 1943 to 1956. So the government has actually been helping us with our food selection. You know, the government is usually an easy target for a lot of things, and we shoot at them a lot. But they've actually, since way back in the last century, what was happening in the late 1800s as far as other things going on in the nutrition world? Harvey Kellogg, that kind of, okay. So we actually have our roots. Nutrition is a very young science as far as science goes, the study of nutrition. 1943 to 1956, and then the four food groups. Most of us grew up with the four food groups, didn't we? That's where I came on the scene. This is what I learned in my first nutrition class, that you need to have milk, meat, vegetables and fruit, and bread. Good, solid meals. 3 squares a day, right? And then soon after that, we adopted this new one over here called the Food Guide Pyramid. This is the most recognizable, identifiable health education tool ever created, but also the least followed. Okay? We can identify it. I mean, there's a vegetarian pyramid. There's an Asian pyramid. There's pyramids for Native Americans, the whole bit. So this was my introduction, and I came out of school with my undergraduate degree promoting the four food groups, thinking this is the way to go. And in fact, why were we in school? This is where the first sign of nutritionism showed up. A friend of mine, a classmate, was working at Hornbacher's in Fargo, North Dakota. And a lady came to the checkout, and she was carrying a peanut butter jar like that, and she panicked out. And she says, quick, give me that back. She grabs it, and she disappears, and she comes back, and she slams it down on the counter, and she says, oh, I almost bought the one that didn't have the no cholesterol label on it. Okay, now my friend's standing there, and she's a nutrition major, and she's looking at the lady, and she's looking at the peanuts. Do you know where does cholesterol come from? Look at you guys, are scholars. It comes from animal products only, okay? Where in the animal is that cholesterol made? In the liver. Okay, last time you cut open a peanut, did you see a liver in there? Okay, this is what I call the first signs of nutritionism. We started marketing food in relationship to individual nutrients, rather than looking at the composite picture. So if it had cholesterol, it's bad, right? So this lady thought, basically it was a marketing ploy by whoever, Skippy or Choosy Mothers, Choose Jif, whatever it was, they were on it and it made sales go up. That is nutritionism, where we're were eating food and selecting food based upon individual nutrients, whether they were in there to begin with or not. So we're adding nutrients to this food and adding nutrients to that food. How do we wade through all this? Okay? So soon after this, right before I graduated from undergraduate in college, I was actually baptized into the Seventh-day Adventist Church on April 2nd, 1988. And I soon moved off to this town called Lincoln, Nebraska, to do a dietetic internship and to work at the med center. And I looked in the catalog and I thought, I think there's an Adventist school around here. And I looked in there and I looked in the catalog and in the telephone book. And sure enough, it was called Union College. And I thought I'd go, some graduates from there? Okay, I thought I'd go out there and hang out with all these on-fire Christian people that were health reformers, right? I didn't even know what the health message was at the time. I was just into lifting weights, playing hockey, not competitively, of course, anymore. And I was just, and I went to prayer meeting, and they were reading this book called The Great Controversy. And I thought, who is this author? And I'd heard about Ellen White, but I had never read her information. Do you know anybody like that? They're against something that they've never read. And then when you read it for yourself, what happens? Something changes. While I was hanging out with some of the Union College students, they gave me this book called Counsels on Diet and Foods. They said, you're a dietitian, you need to read this book. And so I thumbed through it and politely gave it back to them 2 weeks later. But in the meantime, we started reading The Great Controversy, and I suddenly remembered that the same author that wrote The Great Controversy that I was getting excited about had written this book called Counsels on Diet and Foods. And soon after that, I was asked to give a seminar for the church, and I said, oh, I better go find out what that book says so the saints don't fry me, right? They don't grill me, and I can't answer their questions. So I started reading the book, came under some serious conviction, and did a 180 overnight. I said, I've got to try this for 30 days. Daniel only did it for 10 days. I got to do it for 30. So I did a controlled study. You know what a controlled study, a group, and they call it an N, the number in your study. I had one in my study. It was me. I figured I'm convicted about it, before I can tell anybody about it, I got to try it myself. Does that make sense? So I tried it out, and I'm starting to read about this Ellen White lady, and I started reading about John Harvey Kellogg and the flakes and all those things like that and the sanitarium, and I suddenly realized they're reporting back to the book of Genesis, which I embraced. And in Genesis, it gives us the outline for the original diet. I didn't learn this at the university. I got the four food groups. Okay, and when I started reading over here, all four food groups aren't in that list. And I thought, what am I going to do now? I'm a dietitian. I should know how to do this, right? I should be able to quickly do this. I just went to the grocery store and started going through the produce aisle and just grabbing stuff I'd never even seen or heard of before and taking it home and eating it. Now, again, I didn't have a family to change. Some of you have tried to do dietary changes without the support of your family. It's difficult, isn't it? But it's not a contest. It's not a contest. It's a progressive thing. So I started reading this, and I said, I'm going to do this for 30 days. And at the end of the 30-day experiment, I found out I had more energy and vitality. And I thought, I always went to bed thinking, why do we have to have sleep? I have so much energy. I got increased energy from going from the four food groups down to what they would consider a two food group diet. You're cutting half your diet out, right? And then I had mental clarity. This is where it really kicked in, where I really started noticing dietary. I didn't change anything but my diet at the time. I continued to exercise and lift weights and run and do different things like that. But the only thing that changed was my diet. It was a controlled study on myself, 30 days. Mental clarity at the end of that 30 days was off the charts. Have you experienced the same things? When you make dietary change, kind of foggy mind? I didn't realize I was foggy before, but it cleared up big time. And with that mind, I also got a better memory. How many of you could use a little memory kick? Okay? And then something I was not looking for. You're a power lifter, right? Long time ago. A few months ago. But the last thing you want to do is tell a power builder or a bodybuilder, hey, you're going to lose 12 pounds in the next 30 days. That's totally off the charts, but that's what happened, and I didn't even know I was losing weight. And then I got better sleep, and then as a bonus, I just happened to have my cholesterol checked. It went from 165 to 112. There's a long history of heart disease in my family. I am chained to my genetics, they tell me. Not so. Lifestyle makes a difference. This was my 30-day experiment, and I've been telling people about this ever since, 1989. Okay? No looking back. But the interesting thing is now through the years, we have scientific evidence to base what we do based on the Bible. And these people, whether, some are Christians, some are not, some are, I don't even know what they are, but they're out promoting the same thing. Dean Ornish, John McDougall, Colin Campbell, Neil Barnard, Esselstein, our good buddy Hans Diehl with the CHIP program. How many of your churches do CHIP programs? Phenomenal. Excellent program. And then just recently, the Blue Zones. Are you familiar with the Blue Zones? Okay? Loma Linda is a Blue Zone. And you know, how do you know where they got the name Blue Zone from? Do you know where they got that from? You know, we joke about older people having blue hair? Have you ever heard of that? You never heard that. In the Midwest where I come from, that a lot of times they get this blue tint. And that's what I thought they were talking about, the Blue Zones, people with the gray hair that turns blue. It's actually about where they were circling on maps, the Blue Zones, okay? And Loma Linda is a Blue Zone. And just lo and behold, we moved to the Black Hills Health and Education Center, and we saw people every month changing their lifestyle, whether they're Buddhists, okay? We had some Buddhists there. We'd have people from different countries come there. They would get the same results. Men and women, regardless of culture, this program works. And so what I want to show now is that since 2005 to 2011, we had a different pyramid. And then recently, we got a new pyramid. Are you familiar with the Choose My Plate? You can actually go on there and go on this website. There's a whole section now on how to help people educate them on vegetarianism using Choose My Plate. So it's going to be at the end of the slide. And by the way, my website is current right now. Full Circle of Wellness, you can get yesterday's slides off there, and I'll send these slides in when we're done. And you can actually get all this information and all these tools off of there. So Choose My Plate is 1 year old. Okay, so what is nutritionism? How can we wade through this? Nutritionism is basically a reductive idea, a compartmental idea where we're looking at nutrients rather than food. What I'm going to try to do is move you back to food groups or looking at food as a whole. So many times what we find is that even physicians that don't like to prescribe the medication, they're prescribing individual foods for certain conditions. Now, there's a time and a place where you want to eat more nutrients here and more nutrients there, but really what we want to look at is the whole food landscape and start eating food as grown right from nature, as close to nature as possible. Okay? So, the next thing, it's a dominant focus on the parts rather than the whole thing. Used by health professionals, we do this all the time. How many of you actually go in and actually buy a product because it has a certain nutrient in there that never really was in there, and they put it in there, manufactured, and put it in there? What we want to look at is eating the whole food, not parts of the food. And it's actually credited back to this professor over in Australia who coined this word nutritionism, where we're looking at nutrients rather than food. And I'm going to say, let's step back and look at Genesis, and it talks about eating foods there. It doesn't talk about omega-3s. It doesn't talk about ginkgo biloba, even though those are good, and if you want to consume them, fine. But let's look at the big picture so we don't get caught up in all these individual nutrients and all these different little products that are coming out. That's the point. That's the basis. And then if you need a little more vitamin D or a little bit of B12, that's fine. But let's take a big picture look. Here's an example. When I was growing up, I ate Cheerios. My brother ate Rice Krispies. I have one brother. He got Rice Krispies. I got Cheerios. The boxes were basically plain in the front, had the nutrition panel, and that was about it. Now look at this. I didn't know it. Maybe this is why I have lower cholesterol than my brother. Okay? Because my Cheerios may reduce your cholesterol. But my brother's Rice Krispies now help support your child's immunity. And so we're doing that. And then just a couple years ago, I went to Denver, the national organization. Now it's called the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. It used to be American Dietetic Association. We met in Denver. And you know what the big news there was? Apple Jacks. What's the latest thing on Apple Jacks? Have you heard? It now has over 3 grams of fiber per serving. Okay? Because now provides fiber. Okay, so you take a processed food, significantly processed, right, that kids love. Now they're trying to help improve the nutrition. So what do? They start with sugar. Then they go corn flour. And then they go wheat flour. Then they go oat flour. And then they go oat fiber. They added oat fiber into Apple Jacks. so they can boost the nutritional value. So you take something that's depleted of the nutrients and just add something in. This is nutritionism at its finest. And that was the biggest announcement at the American Dietetic Association meeting in Denver. And I thought, really? That's where we're at? We're promoting now, we're excited about 3 grams of fiber in Apple Jacks. So, let's make a deal, is what I think. How many grew up with that show? That's right, you guys didn't watch TV, I did, because I wasn't a Christian at the time. But we had, let's make a deal. And that's what I feel like I am being pushed to as a dietitian, is to let's make a deal. If you don't like this, you can do this, and you can add this to it. And really, the big mantra of the day is, everything in moderation. That's the mantra. So I want to ask you, how is the moderation working for Americans today in their health? Is it working? I take this very, responsibly, real seriously, that it's my occupational responsibility to help people. There's one dietitian for every 5,000 people in the United States. What has happened since I became part of the food police? What has happened in America? Let's take a look at it. I just happen to have some slides right here that you can download for free. If you're a health educator or you want these slides, go to the cdc.gov website, and you'll get these same slides on what's happened in America since 1985 when I took my first nutrition class, 85, 86. Check this out. This is the obesity trends in the United States of America where we live. What's going on? We have more dietitians than ever before. We have more health information than ever before. We have more nutrients being stuck in foods than ever before. We have more treadmills sold every year. We have more health clubs than ever before. How are we doing? So what's wrong? Let's take a look at it. Okay. So in 1985, they were doing phone surveys, and they were asking people, how tall are you and how much do you weigh? And that's put into a formula called the BMI. Body mass index. Have you heard of it? Okay. So your BMI, it's basically saying, how much earth are you taking up? How much space are you taking up? And I always joke to my students that here in North America, have you ever driven through Wyoming? Is anybody from Wyoming? You're from Wyoming? Okay. I'm going to be kind now, okay, a little bit. But least populated, there's a lot of room there. Okay, there's a lot of room. There used to be a lot more room in western North Dakota until they hit oil. Okay? And so what we find is that in America, we have lots of space to move around, so we have a lot of room to grow. You go to some of the Asian countries, their BMI is lower because they don't have as much room, right? But they're running out of room because they're getting larger too. And this is not an American situation. It's across the board. But look at this. So they started collecting data that they, meaning the Center for Disease Control, they keep an eye on our health. We've got the USDA looking at our food. This is our overall health. And they started collecting data saying, how many people are actually in the overweight or obesity category? And this is specifically obesity trends in American U.S. adults, basically 30 pounds or more over their ideal weight. Now, the BMI, you know what's interesting? My students always tell me when they find that they're high in the BMI, they say, that doesn't take into consideration how much muscle I have. Yeah. And mom used to say that you were just big boned when you're heavy when you're young, right? But this is one of the most accurate population-wide ways to assess the health of people, because why are we so concerned about obesity? Is it just a beauty thing? When your obesity goes up, what goes up with it? Heart disease, cancer, stroke. So it's an indication of what's going on inside. Inflammation. So let's go back. 1985, what was going on in America? Now, the white states here, they were not collecting data. They hadn't gotten on board yet. All right? The light blue, less than 10% of the adult population, okay, that you'd see on the street in those states in 1985 were obese, 10 to 14 in the dark. My state of North Dakota started out right. We wanted to be up there. We were big boned. Okay? So in 1985, and check this out. That's 1986, 1987, 1988, 1989, okay? 1990, what's going on? And people said, and my students, when I show them this, they say, why didn't somebody say something? We said, we've been telling you this for years, right? Check this out. Check this trend out. Okay? Okay, we had to add, look at this, we added a category in 1991 because look at this, some of these states here, the Bible Belt, down in here, Michigan, West Virginia. There we go. Arkansas. And look at Wyoming is still holding out. They said, we're too busy counting mule deer. We have more mule deer than we have people in Wyoming. Seriously, there's more mule deer in the state of Wyoming than there are people. Okay? But they also have a positive budget in their state budget because they have natural gas and coal. Okay? Anyway, there, they finally got on board. But look at, by the time we hit 1994, this whole eastern part of the United States is almost 15 to 19% of them are obese. We're not talking a little chubby or pinch an inch. We're talking 30 pounds overweight. Okay? Look at there. 1995. Oh, look at Oregon. What happened out here? You guys started eating more Fruit Loops or what? Out here. Then we had to add another category in 1997. One in five adults that you'd meet on the street are considered obese in those three states. 1998. 1999. What's going on in America? More dietitians graduated there that were supposed to help with this. My group. Okay? Look at that. 2000. 2001, we added another category. One in every four people that you met on the street in Mississippi were obese. Okay? 2002. 2003. Now, what do you get out of that? You know what I tell my students all the time? Is that you need to move to the Rocky Mountains. Look at the leanest people live in this Rocky Mountain region right there. Is it geographic? Some of this is geographic. Okay? 2004. 2005. We added another category in 2005 because of these two states down here. Over 30%, that's basically a third of the adults in those two states, Louisiana, Mississippi, are obese. The only ones that are holding out right here are Colorado. It looks like Rhode Island or one of them. 2007, 2008, 2009, and 2010. This is the most recent data. We don't have the 2011 data yet. That's where we're at. So what's going on? What are your grandkids going to look like on this scale? That's what I ask my students all the time. Where are your children going to be at when it's time for them to be adults? So what was that? So there we go. That's the condition we're in. And nutrition plays a huge part of this. There's other factors, but I'm going to focus just on nutrition. But it's interesting to see that even former President Clinton is now getting on board with this plan that we're going to be talking about. Have you seen the reports? He had some stents put in. His daughter was getting married. And he says, I need to change this up. And he went on a plant-based diet under the supervision of Esselstyn's program. Okay? And the interesting thing is, here's some personal data that I've collected. People going through the Black Hills Health and Education Center in 3 weeks or less, their inflammation factors, okay, the CRP, goes down by 30%. Total cholesterol drops by 11%, LDL 13, triglycerides by 14, fasting glucose by 6%. And this is universal across the board, males and females, Native Americans, blacks, whites, the whole bit. So let's take a look at it. How can we cooperate with the way our bodies were intended to operate? Let's get right to it. Our body is made up of millions and millions of cells. We have cells dying off. We have cells multiplying, replicating, and growing every day. How do those cells get the structure in the building blocks for the cell membranes? Where's it coming from? It has to come from our food. So what kind of food you're putting into your body today is most likely going to be what kind of condition you're going to be in a year from now. When you start replacing cells, just think about that. When they built this building right here, do you think they went down to the lumber yard and they said, you know what, can you give us a great deal? They probably said that. Give us a great deal. But did they say, do you have any like old, you know, twisted, what are these, 8x8s or something? Do you have any like twisted 8x8s or some old lumber in the back, some rusty nails you could give us a cut rate deal on? Probably not. They probably said, you know what, they probably went back there and somebody went through and looked at those 8x8s and the 2x8s and the 2x10s and the 2x12s, and they looked at them and they said, are these straight? We take more regard sometimes in the way we build buildings than we do the way we care for our bodies. And so what we should be looking at is, if this is really our dream home, so to speak, that we're going to be living in while we're on this earth, we should be looking at the materials we're putting in there and what kind of cells we're building in our body for tomorrow and the next week, and what are we feeding the rest of our family? Are we feeding them twisted 2x4s and all these things? That's why we're so twisted and we're getting, in a sense, earlier and earlier onset of diseases in children. And a lot of it has to do with what we're putting in our body. So this is the organ systems and so forth. We're built up by the food we eat. You break down the human body, it's broken down into cells. And the only way those cells can really build is if we give it the proper nourishment, the proper building blocks every day when we put our food into our body. Do the best you can. That's the bottom line. If you're going to go to sleep right now and you're going to miss the rest of it, just do the best you can. It's not a contest. Be progressively improving on this. Okay? So if you can understand how this system we call the digestive system operates in the body, if you know how that operates, how it tends to, wants to operate, if you can understand that, you can make your food selection. So what I want to do is a little bit of anatomy and physiology, okay? Now, some people are intimidated by anatomy and physiology. All you have to do is think about is parts and function, okay? Parts and function. What are the parts doing? That's anatomy. And how they're functioning? That's physiology. Don't be intimidated by your body. It's the most marvelous organism on this earth, and we sometimes don't know enough about it. So let's take a look at it. So basically what we're going to do is look at, how does food that has nutrients locked up in it, how can we liberate those nutrients so they can go in and help build good cells so we can get our nutrients into our body and get the waste products out? We spend so much time talking about the nutrients in, and it's usually not polite, but we need to talk a little bit about the waste products, getting the waste products out of the body. Okay? So some of us are toxic. We're building up waste products in our body, and we'll get to that. Okay, so let's get into it. The digestive system. This is digestion 101. Okay, so we start out. Did you know that even before you eat food, digestion starts kicking in? What's going on there? Salivation. What's causing that? Just the sight and smell of food can actually cause you to salivate, can actually cause you to create hydrochloric acid in the stomach. Do you know that there's actually bakeries? If they're smart, they actually have exhaust fans, and they exhaust their smell out into the streets, and you get into a trance. You've seen that? Bagel. Right? And you go in there, and actually what they're doing is they're playing on what they call the vagus nerve. I like to call it the Las Vegas nerve because it excites you. My brother lives in Vegas, okay? So you have this Las Vegas system that on the sight and smell of food, it's telling you to go eat, go eat, go eat. Well, now if you've already eaten it, somehow you have to have some kind of mechanism to turn that off, right? People have actually had vagotomies. They've actually had that nerve severed because they create too much hydrochloric acid, just being stimulated all the time. How many of you, while you're cooking, can't keep your hand out of the dish? Your vagus nerve is being stimulated. You got to test it. That's right. That's a lack of faith, sister. I couldn't help. Sorry about that. We used to, you know, when I first grabbed this thing, I was left brain dominant. Before I waited until I was 30 years old to get married. Right? But you know what? What happens when you get a 30-year-old male who's been single that long? I bit right into the light bearer's materials, hook, line, and sinker. That was good stuff, right? Think about that. How many, like, I'm 49. So that's, I've been around this stuff for quite a while. But I tell you what, I was so rigid. I mean, I had my whole system set up and so forth like that, so that when we started our restaurant, our first restaurant, my wife and I started as business partners, and I brought her on as a cook, and we were business partners, and suddenly the heat was on in the kitchen and there was no stove on. We said, we better check this out, okay? So we started out, and we got going, and people would come in, and they say, how's the soup today? And I said, I don't know. I haven't eaten it yet. I don't eat between meals, right? And I said, if I have to test it, that's a lack of faith. I'm confident it's so good. Off the subject. Okay, here we go. I'm kind of getting in gear here because this is my passion. Okay, so what do we have going on besides the salivary juice and all that stuff? What's going on in the oral cavity that's preparing for, it looks like an apple, right? So what's going to go on? The digestion, what's going on in the mouth? You got this. Why is the salivary glands there? Enzymes to break down carbohydrates. But not fats yet. We're just going to do carbohydrates, a little bit of fats, not a lot. Okay? So then what else do we have going on in the mouth that's found nowhere else in the rest of the body? Taste buds. Why do you women have 44 cookbooks? And we need another one. You're probably buying another one this week. Right? Okay, so taste buds. It has to taste good, right? That's where big on taste buds. What else is in the mouth that's found nowhere else in the rest of the body? Teeth. Come on. Teeth, right? There are no teeth in your stomach. Did you know that? There's no taste buds in your stomach. So why do we eat our food so fast? In America, we do it and we gulp down. I used to drink 4 glasses of milk with every meal to get that food down. I lived right off campus my last couple years, and I'd go home and put MTV on, right? And then boom, 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 and I'm guessing how much food I'm going to eat, and I've got a half hour, and I'm drinking it all. And when I'm back in class, the rock and roll is going on in my stomach because I've got big wads of food in there. I never chewed it. Okay, the more thoroughly you chew your food, the more efficient, okay, you're going to absorb the nutrients. That's the key. And the interesting thing is we do all this food preparation, all these cookbooks for our taste buds, and then we just slam it down in 12 or 15 minutes rather than enjoying it. We'll watch a three-hour Food Network, I'm sorry, 3ABN Cooking Network cooking demo, right? And then want to cook or do our meal in 12 minutes or less. That's an oxymoron. My students will watch 3 hours of Food Network and then go microwave a meal. We'll go to a three-hour football game or watch the Miami Heat for 3 hours, right? 180 minutes and have a hard time getting in 20 minutes of exercise that week. We are schizophrenic as a people. We are. So if all this is going on in the mouth, let's slow down and chew our food thoroughly. Most digestive problems is because we're eating too quickly and we're drinking too many liquids with our meals. Acid reflux. Acid reflux. I've literally assisted people, and I don't take any credit for it because I'm just following the designer's manual. If you don't eat between meals, if you chew your food thoroughly, if you don't drink a lot of liquids with your meal, acid reflux, kiss it goodbye. It's gone. Hiking with a new church member a couple of years ago in the Black Hills on a Sabbath afternoon, and he's saying how he's taking all these Nexium and all these purple pills. You know people that take acid reflux stuff? Tums and Rolaids? They eat them like candy. And they're expensive. And I used to try to make deals with people. Now, if I can get you off your medication, can we split whatever money you're saving? And then we'll just call it even? So I'm hiking with this new church member, and he's talking about acid reflux. And the interesting thing is most of these meds don't even really do away with it. They still have it. They're maintaining it. It's managing their acid reflux. And I said, a couple of things here. Chew your food thoroughly, don't eat a lot of liquids, and spread your meals out. And I forgot about it. Saw him a couple weeks later, and he says, man, I'm off all my meds. Following the plan. Simple things. If you just understand how this operates or how it wants to operate, you can forget about a lot of this stuff. So, chew your food thoroughly. Okay? The oral cavity, there's teeth. There's no teeth in your stomach. Do you know that, what is it, the lobster and the crawfish have a tooth in their stomach? So when they shed their exoskeleton, they can eat it and get the calcium back? Isn't it crawfish that have that? Last time we looked in the anatomy lab, the cadavers I looked at, we don't have any teeth in our stomach. So let's just use the ones we have up top, chew it thoroughly, and let's let our taste buds have some fun. If our wives and even the guys, how many of you men do food prep? Men? Yeah? That's great. I think it should be an equal opportunity situation where the men do it too. But the interesting thing is if we're going to take all that time and go through all that inconvenience to make this food, let's let our taste buds have some fun and masticate it and chew it, enjoy, slow down. Have you heard of this slow food movement? Have you heard of this? Google that once. There's a slow food movement going against all this fast food and meals in 28 minutes or less and all that stuff. Slow food movement. It's a grassroots movement. I think there's a big group out here in Oregon. It's a slow foods movement. It's a move back to natural foods where you sit down and actually enjoy the dining experience. And you're not rushing the meal. Enjoy it. That should be some time where you really actually connect with one another as families. I remember growing up, I couldn't, unless I was in the hospital or had a leg, you know, almost amputated, I couldn't miss supper. I had to be home, and we were closer because of it. We're missing that. Okay, so after we've chewed our food thoroughly, masticated it, enjoyed it, it starts going down this long tube right here. And you know, it's funny when you're like a sophomore in college and you're taking anatomy and physiology. It's interesting. We had a professor from a Asian country, and I think he got hooked on phonics to learn English. And he would stand there. We would actually go to our class and then stand out in the hallway and listen to him lecture to the next class because he was so humorous, trying to chew up the English language. And he would stand right here. And after the food leaves the mouth, it goes right down here through the esophagus. <It's>, So the food comes down the esophagus. And what's it end up? What's the esophagus connected to on the bottom side? The stomach. What's going on in the stomach? Tell me about the stomach. What, you are a piece of food molecule. You've been through the taste buds. You've been through the teeth. You've been down this long esophagus slide. And you hit the stomach. What are you doing in there? What kind of environment? Acid. What's that acid doing in there? Is that a malfunction of design? Break down what? Protein. Predominantly, we're going to break down protein. So where's protein coming from? Why do we need protein? Build the body, enzymes, hormones, those types of things. So what's going on in here? Is that acid there, what's it doing there? Should we take some Tums and Rolaids to get that acid down? Must be a defect. It helps break down the food, okay? One of the worst things we can do is to go in there and neutralize that acid. Because what happens if we neutralize that acid or dilute it down? It's going to slow down digestion. The food's just going to sit in there and just kind of rumble around and wait and wait and wait. So what's the first thing we do a lot of times when we're eating our food to dilute that acid? We drink a lot of fluids. So what I'm suggesting to you to do is to minimize how much liquid you're drinking with your meals. Use the other sides of the meals to drink your liquids. Okay? And this is the reason why. This is probably the number one thing if you know someone with acid reflux is if they would cut back on the amount of liquid. Okay? During the meal. But the interesting thing is there's a valve here and there's a valve on top. Okay? And the food's in there and then acid's in there. It's breaking down mostly protein, a little bit of fat. And then it starts getting ready to come through here. And what we want to do is we want that batch. The body digests in what we call a batch mode method. If you dump in more food on top of the food that's in there, what's going to happen? It's going to start all over again and putrefy. Now, I always use the illustration, and what we look at right here is a lot of time when I was growing up, I grew up by a town called Devil's Lake, North Dakota. It's the central flyway for geese, goose hunting. Okay, so my grandpa would take us to this called the two spot, and my brother and I would eat these huge pancakes, right? And we'd put all this syrup on there. And then what we put on top, we put some nice fruit on top of there, strawberries. Okay, and then we'd go out and lay down and get horizontal in a duck blind, in a goose blind. Okay? And so after a while, all this baking powder and baking soda is neutralizing the acid in here. Right? And we're sitting there and we're laying down in a horizontal position waiting for these geese to fly over our decoys and to come land in our decoys. And while we're in there, the food's sitting in there and it's starting to ferment and percolate. And then we start having, you know, yeah, gas. So what you want to do is if you want to fill up a family on a low budget, use a lot of baking powder and baking soda, okay, and it'll blow up their stomach and it'll sit in there for hours. Don't recommend that, okay? But what we want to do is we want to cooperate with this. We want the acid at full strength when the food comes through. We want to eat our meal, not spread it out or be crowding other meals into it so we can have this efficient digestion. Because what's happening when fermentation is taking place in here, it starts clouding the brain. That's the bottom line. It's just clouding your brain up and you can't think clear thoughts. Okay? So once the food's ready to go through here, okay, we start coming into the first part of the small intestine. But the interesting thing is that when the food's sitting in here, the body is so amazing. I just love lecturing on this to my students when I tell them, you know what, there's actually a text message sent from the stomach to the liver saying, hey, this guy had some fat. He ate some fats. So how do we break down fats in the human body? Bile. And where's bile made? In the liver. But the stomach, there's a circuitry in here that the organs are talking to one another. And the stomach actually gets on the line and text messages the liver and says, he ate some fat, get ready to release some bile. Now, the liver makes the bile, but it stores it in the gallbladder. Does that make sense? You can live. Did you know that you can actually live just fine without a gallbladder? A lot of people are doing it. My grandmother did it for years. She donated parts of her organs while she was living. She was a living donor. Okay? And so what we have here is that signal sent from the stomach to the liver to the gallbladder saying he just ate some fat. So when the food comes down here, it starts squirting out some bile acids and it coats the fat and starts breaking it down. Okay? What happens is we eat a low fiber diet, a lot of bile gets stuck in here. We create bile stones or gallstones. One of the most common surgeries today is to do 3 incisions over here. They go in with a scope, zap it, and suck it out. Very common. Hundreds of them done every day. You can actually cleanse your gallbladder with different methods without having that done. Okay? So what happens is the liver here now, and so what's the number one constituent part of bile? If you dissected bile, what's the number one ingredient in bile? Cholesterol. Okay? So the interesting thing is a lot of people go around trying to get their cholesterol down. So the more fat I eat, the more bile I'm going to make. So what am I going to make more of the more fat I eat? More cholesterol. It's a common sense approach. So if you want the first step in if somebody wanted to get their cholesterol down, they start cutting out the amount of cholesterol they're eating first, which cholesterol only comes from animals that actually have a liver. And every animal I know has a liver. Okay? Peanuts, remember we talked about peanuts. You dissect a peanut or a bean, okay? Or an avocado. That's a pit in there. It's not a liver. Okay? So what we have here is that the less fat you eat, the less cholesterol your body is going to produce. So you naturally lower your cholesterol when you cut back on the amount of fat, especially saturated fats. And most of the saturated fats are found in animal products. Okay, so we've got the stomach here communicating to the liver, coming down, the fat's breaking down, and then the pancreas kind of plays cleanup batter, and it cleans up everything. It releases enzymes that break down carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. So if you haven't digested it by that point, the pancreas is going to do it. And then basically we go all the way along through the small intestine and through here, and this is where all the absorption and so forth is taking place of the nutrients. And then when we get right down to here, to this last part, okay, over here in the ileum of the small intestine, this is the last part of the small intestine before it goes into the large intestine, right there. That's where cholesterol that's in the small intestine actually absorbs into the bloodstream. Okay? So let's tie this into the Cheerios box. It says, may reduce the risk of heart disease. Nutritionism 101. So what's going on there? How does Cheerios reduce cholesterol? The fiber. How's the fiber working? It's working like a sponge. Okay? So what happens is, so just say you happen to have a birthday party and you ate a little extra fat. And you're worried about your cholesterol. Right? What you do is you make sure that you're always eating whole foods that have fiber in them. You could actually eat Apple Jacks now because it had more fiber, right? So what we're doing is the fiber's coming along here. Think of your fiber like a sponge, a dry sponge, okay? Sometimes it tastes like a sponge, right? I just thought of that, okay? But it doesn't always, okay? That's not very appealing to somebody who doesn't like fiber, is it? Sponge. But think of it like a spongy factor, and it's coming down through here in the small intestine, and it's going through here, and it's sponging up bile acids, and it's sponging up cholesterol. Now, fiber will not be absorbed from the human digestive tract into the bloodstream. We don't absorb fiber into the system. So what happens is it stays in here. The sponge comes along, and it absorbs all the bile acids, which sometimes a lot of bile acids actually contributes to colon cancer. Did you know that? There's a link between bile acids, frequent meals, a lot of bile acids frequently through the day, eating lots of meals close together, more bile acid produced, more colon cancer risk. Hooked to bile acids, exposure to bile acids. But if we're eating the fiber, it's coming through here and it's sucking up in that sponge and it's holding on and giving a bear hug to the cholesterol, And so that when it goes right by here, the ileum, it doesn't get absorbed through the bloodstream. The cholesterol doesn't. It stays in the sponge, okay, the fiber. And then it comes down here, and it comes into the ascending colon, the transverse colon, and over here, descending colon, and it comes over here, and it goes outside the body. So you're basically making fiber pies. Okay. So what's interesting is in where we moved from in Nebraska to Arizona, they actually have a buffalo chip throwing contest on the 4th of July. They're fiber pie throwing contest. Okay? So you don't absorb the fiber, and it goes through here, and it hangs on to the bile, and it hangs on to the cholesterol, and it takes it right out of the body. Does that make sense? Is that clear? Now you can explain, and now you usually we say, oh, it's just something with, you know, it kind of hangs on over there, but sometimes you want to go to the next level. Now you know how. So you think of two types of sponges, soluble and insoluble sponges, fibers, okay? The soluble fibers are the ones that are really sucking it up. Think about your beans when you soak your beans or whatever you soak and you wake up in the morning, they're all over your counter. Has that ever happened to you? Or am I the only one? Okay, I'm the only one. All right, but if it expands, that's a soluble fiber. That's a spongy fiber absorbing things. And then the other kind are like brooms coming down here and cleaning this out. Okay? So what we have basically here, there's the appendix. Did you know where the appendix is? Right there? It's part of your immune system. Okay? And a lot of times when we have appendicitis, what's happening is it's plugging up the colon right there with the low-fiber diet, and it's getting impacted with bile acids and fecal matter. And it inflames. And then people have it just taken out. They donate that organ to science while they're living. Okay? And so we get rid of the appendix, we get rid of the gallbladder and the tonsils. All extra equipment that was put there by mistake. No. If we cooperate with the way this is intended to operate, we suddenly realize we don't need those things ripped out. They actually help with the immune system. The tonsils are part of the immune system. Okay? So what do you think about that? And so basically, okay, we'll go to this part. What about this part? Talking about bowel movements. Okay? Now, if you're going to increase your fiber, now, I recommend that you get at least 30 grams of fiber a day, at least. And you just naturally will get that if you transition and stay predominantly on a whole foods, plant-based diet. And what we're finding out that is really sometimes people have years of fecal matter built up in crust layers, like on the earth. You look at the earth where you go through a canyon, you see all these layers. That's what's happening. Sometimes we have years and years of debris and waste products that are kind of clouding the mind. We want to clean this out. We want to start doing this. But you always want to increase your fiber slowly. Okay? That sounds humorous, but I have to share with you one experience I had. It was back when I was in college. We had an away game, and it was a trip for college hockey. We were taking a bus trip for two hours to Bemidji, Minnesota, and I was taking my first nutrition class, and I said, okay, I'm really going to perform well here. I'm going to go buy a bag of apples and a box of raisins. And I ate them all the way to the hockey game. Okay, I played two shifts in that game. I had so much abdominal cramping and squirts and diarrhea that I couldn't play in the hockey game, okay? But when you're increasing your fiber, you also have to increase your water intake a little bit, or it could plug you up. The sponges, they like to have some water to help move them along, because what happens is this large intestine right here, it has a muscular band around it, and when it expands, it pushes. And when it expands, it pushes. So as the fiber's coming in here, the large intestine's actually pushing it along here and actually pushing it out of the body. Okay? Now, if you go on antibiotics, if you go on a bout of antibiotics, it's going to destroy. We have actually a floral lining all through here, small and large intestine. There's a nice, delicate balance where that's part of our immune system. But when we go on antibiotics, cycle basically destroys all the floral lining in here, the good and bad bacteria. So we always want to follow up, if you go on some antibiotics, is to follow that up with some probiotics, some live organisms, okay? And you can get that in soy yogurt, or if you want to do acidophilus, starts building up that floral lining here, which boosts your immune system. Okay? So, do you understand the digestive tract? If you can understand that, you can make your food choices and the habits you make accordingly. That's what we have. So that's basically the large intestine, the small intestine, going back up all the way up into the mouth. Hopefully that's helped. Well, we're going to skip over that. That's basics of the nutrition. I wanted to make sure I covered those. We got the carbohydrates, the proteins, fats, vitamins, minerals, those types of things. Make sure we have plenty of water. And what I want you to do is start emphasizing when you eat food. How do you select food now? Let's start taking a look at it. What I want to do is get you focusing on nutrient density. How many nutrients are you getting for the amount of calories you're eating? That's called nutrient density. Okay? Just like if you were buying something, you want to get the best deal for your money. Same thing when you're making your food choices. You want to eat the most nutrient-dense foods. And what I started doing about 10 years ago is that every time I ate a meal, okay, when I got ready to eat a meal, the first thing I did is eat something fresh, whole food first. Do you ever notice that when you go to a restaurant, they bring you out your dinner salad, the most nutritious food, and it's the smallest thing? And then they bring you the least nutrient thing, and it's the largest thing? Flip that around and eat it first. Did you ever also notice that when you try to eat your fresh whole foods in the middle or late part of your meal, you don't eat as much of it? Either you're full or it doesn't taste as good. Start every single meal with the most nutrient-dense foods you have. That's the first place to start. If you want to kind of kickstart what you're doing, you're going to get more energy, you're going to get more vitamins, you're going to get more minerals, and that's the key. A lot of times we focus on carbohydrates, proteins, and fats, and we don't talk about vitamins and minerals, but that's really where the focus needs to be. Okay, so let's take a little tour down nutrient density alley, okay? Think about that. How many of you like corn? Sweet corn. Sweet corn, okay? How many of you like corn oil? Okay? Corn oil comes from corn, right? Obviously, butter, not dairy butter, but margarine and stuff like that. One medium ear of corn is 75 calories. Only has 1 gram of fat and 2 grams of fiber. Okay, can you think about that for a minute? The nutrient density there. How would you rate that on nutrient density? Very good. Low calorie. Probably has a fair amount of nutrients. Definitely has a little bit of fiber. And look at this. 1 tablespoon of corn oil. 120 calories. 13 grams of fat. No fiber. So what they do is they shuck the corn. And they put it through some big steel rollers. Okay? And the oil comes out. What do we have? We have 13 grams of fat. There's 1 gram of fat there. So what that equals? 13 ears of corn and 1 tablespoon of corn oil. That is not nutrient density. That's calorie density. This ties into a little bit again on how this America is becoming darker and darker on those slides. More obesity, because you could sit down and what do they bring you at a Mexican restaurant before you get your meal? Big bag of chips or bowls of chips, right? And we slam those things. We probably eat 13, 14, 20 ears of corn while we're sitting there. The equivalent, right? Okay? 10 pounds of milk to make 1 pound of cheese. Okay? And we get all kinds of... Have you heard about casomorphines? That's a whole nother... Just Google it. Casomorphine. Have you ever heard of the word of morphine? We think of drug dealers, right? People on the street with needles, right? Breast milk, whether it's any of the mammals, okay, with the breast milk, mothers, cows, whatever, they have a constituent molecule in there for the bonding purposes of mother and the offspring called a morphine, a casomorphine in the protein, in the milk. That's why some of you have had a hard time. You wanted to give up dairy, right? But you couldn't get off cheese, right? My menace, my thorn in the flesh, cheese, right? Well, there's some chemicals in there that actually keep you attached to your food, okay? 11 pounds of milk for 1 pound of non-fat dry milk, and then Ben and Jerry, okay? I think was it Ben or Jerry just had his bypass a couple years ago? Anyway, they had a bypass, I wonder why. 12 pounds of milk for 1 pint of Ben and Jerry's ice cream. 230 pounds per person of caloric sweeteners. Basically, I'm talking about nutrient density. This is calorie density on the other end of the spectrum. Lots of calories, not a lot of nutrients. So we have a lot of people that are overfed and undernourished in America. And it's interesting how the body will add on a new room whenever you need it. Add on a new closet. Okay, it'll just add it on. Okay? Grow it out there. 49 teaspoons. Yeah, it'll just add it on wherever you need it. 49 teaspoons per day per person. Very calorie dense, not very nutrient dense. 13 pounds of grain for 1 pound of beef, 6 pounds of grain for 1 pound of pork, and 3 pounds of grain for 1 pound of chicken. Eat your foods straight from nature. Don't have to funnel them through other sources, is what we're getting at here. And here we go. 1 meatball for 100 calories, okay? Or you can have a cup and a quarter of black bean soup for 100 calories. Nutrient density, Calorie density. Okay? Same thing down here with the cheese and the pumpkin soup. Okay. So, getting ready to close it up right here. So, Dr. Furman. How many of you heard of Joel Furman? Christian physician from New Jersey? I think he was a former Olympic skater, something like that. He's an MD, counsels his people. Excellent thing. He goes into this nutrient density. He actually went in and scored foods. Cola, French fries, vanilla ice cream. The lower the score on the nutrient density ranking, the worse off it is. More calories than there are nutrients. White bread, white pasta, whole milk. This is where most of America is hanging out. Low nutrient-dense foods, low energy, lots of disease. We're not feeding the body the nutrients it needs. Highly processed foods over here. Okay? There's the peanut butter. Very calorie-dense. Okay? Not a lot of nutrients for the amount of calories used sparingly. Okay? Then we go to the middle category. And this is where I start my students. I start telling my students, they're over here, then switch categories and start eating more foods over here. Be progressively improving more nutrient-dense food. Here's tofu, avocados, shrimp, almonds, okay? Very calorie-dense foods, okay? They're still good foods, okay? But you want to look at them. You probably don't want to eat those first in the meal. What we want to look at is eating in a sequential manner, cantaloupe and so forth. And then we get over here. Here's the stalwarts. Kale, collards, bok choy, spinach, broccoli, Chinese cabbage, Brussels sprouts, Swiss chard. Have I hit any foods that you eat yet?
Yes.
Okay, just checking. Just a survey. Just checking. Kale and so forth. Then we get down into here. Romaine lettuce. Okay? Carrots, broccoli, cauliflower. But look at that. They pegged the needle up here with kale, collard greens. The amount of nutrients you're getting for the amount of calories is off the charts. Some of you do green drinks, don't you? You juice your greens, right? Look at that. You're off the charts. So start thinking about this. Pick these slides up off of my website. They'll be on there hopefully later on today or tomorrow. Or you can go on Dr. Furman's, Google him and find it. Use this. I put this on the fridge. So I try to eat from this category right away the first part of the meal. So I'm getting nutrient-dense foods in my body first. And then you can fill it in with some of these other foods over here that aren't quite as nutrient-dense, but you really enjoy, and then you get your other nutrients from. Okay, let's close this thing up. Dr. Dean Ornish, he came to Weimar a few years ago. Well, I guess it's back quite a while now since we were there. And he sent his researchers over there because he heard about Weimar. And he found out that they were doing this type of thing, this whole dietary practice, live-in program, and he was doing it in the Bay Area. And they've been doing it over at Weimar since what, the 70s, 60s, 70s? And they come over there and said, we're yesterday's news. But then he still continues to do his research. He's just more published than the rest of us. And what does he say? I don't understand why asking people to eat a well-balanced vegetarian diet is considered drastic. Some people think that's drastic, right? And he's saying, I don't know why. He says, well, it's medically conservative to cut people open and put them on cholesterol-lowering drugs for the rest of their lives. What do you think? Is it better to follow the cooperation method with the way you're intended to operate?
Yes.
Or the other way? We can do this for ourselves, for our family, and then encourage others to do it as well. In closing, it's funny. We're living in this age of nutritionism, right? More dietitians than ever before. And it takes a journalism professor from University of California, Berkeley, of all places, to tell us how to eat. You can go get this article. If I would have read this article 30 years ago, I probably wouldn't have had to get a nutrition degree. But it took a journalism professor, 20-page article. You can get it online. I put the link in the last slide. You can get it. It's called Unhappy Meals in New York Times Magazine. He says we're eating nutrients rather than food, and he sums it up in a couple sentences right here. Eat food, real food. Not too much, mostly plants. That's the health message as far as the dietary aspect. Eat real food, not processed, not all these things with labels and all these crinkly packages and all that things. Eat food, not too much, but eat mostly plants. That's pretty simple, isn't it? Can you do that? That's where we progressively move towards. Okay? So we're going to, there's the slide, here's the link. These links will be on there. There's the link for the Unhappy Meals if you want to read a 20-page article by Michael Pollan, who takes this, really, all this nutrition information and puts down basically about the equivalent of a bachelor's degree in nutrition in a 20-page article. So, have you had enough? Let's, pardon me, my website, It's right on the page there. Well, some of you didn't get a handout, right? You're fighting over your handout. FullCircleOfWellness.com. And I'm going to warn you, it's not a commercial website. I'm not going to sell you anything on there. All it is a place to park documents. There's no fancy graphics. There's no funky looking things. I'm sure Yamel is going to try to change that on me, try to get me jazzed up and into the 21st century. But it's just basically a place to park documents. And I also recommend you go back and read Councils on Diet and Foods. Very practical information. What I'm sharing you, some of this stuff I share with you from Michael Pollan, Dean Ornish, basically supports what we read in these books and in Genesis 1. Okay. Do you have questions? I think they want us to use a microphone. And so there's no blanks if we record it. Okay. So why don't you come up here and we can take some questions and answer. If you want to leave, or if you want to just keep napping right in here, that's fine too, I think. I'm not offended. I have students fall asleep on me all the time. And I figure if I can help put you to sleep and you need to sleep, that's a benefit for both of us. Okay, go ahead.
You said not to eat or not to drink during meals. So like how previous and how post?
Okay. You know, this is one of the most common questions because, I mean, I grew up, like I said, 3-4 glasses of milk at every meal. Big glasses, cold milk. Just slam that thing, right? And I just think that really what you need to look at is just do it. If you need to do a little sipping while you're eating, that's fine. But I think ideally you'd probably stop drinking ideally about a half hour before you eat. I mean, you don't have to set alarm clocks. I mean, I did that when I first got into this, you know, and I thought, well, I'm just going to do this 100%. And I'm almost like 30 minutes, no more drinking water. And then an hour afterwards, you can start drinking again. And sometimes you need rules. So you get new habits, and after that, you can just kind of go on principles. But I would think about a half hour before you eat, so your enzymes are full strength, and your stomach acids are going to be ready to go. And just sip your liquids with your meals if you need a little bit to help with your cravings and things like that. I would think about an hour. Just kind of go by how you feel. Does that help? Okay. Got a question?
Two. With the soluble fiber, that's the fiber that absorbs fluid, like beans.
Exactly.
Psyllium seed, that type of thing?
That's right.
Okay, so the insoluble would be like a broom, but give me some examples of that.
The husk on like wheat fiber?
Oh, okay.
Those types
so
of things?
Whole grain type
Whole
thing?
Grains, exactly. Okay. Some of the pectins and stuff on fruits.
Okay.
Or insoluble fiber, peelings on, yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Another thing, we've just recently been diagnosed as parasites in our blood. It's by a specialized doctor in Scottsdale, a rare type of protozoa. Anyway, he says we can never get well. We will be on antibiotics the rest of our life. So when I was talking to him, I said, what about acidophilus? Because I know that the antibiotics will destroy the acidophilus. He said, oh, yeah, take that. And I'm going, doesn't add up to me how you can be on antibiotics but yet keep taking acidophilus. What's the...
I'm thinking your antibiotics are going to be destroying the
right.
effectiveness of the acidophilus.
Right. So what do you do? Now, I'm choosing to do an herbal thing. My husband is choosing to not. We're actually... This has been going on so long, we're actually getting some organ damage.
Okay.
So we need to really step up to the plate here. Hey,
are you familiar with Danny Vieira?
Of course. I've been there. Yeah.
I would talk to him.
Talk to him.
He's more of the cleansing parasite specialist. I've kind of gotten out of that a little bit.
Hulda Clark also is, I have.
Yeah, in Schultz, Dr. Yeah. Schultz, uh-huh, Schultze. Uh-huh. Schultz?
But you can go on the cleanses, but in the meantime, to keep the disease at bay or the damage at bay, and you're on the antibiotics, hopefully we're going to switch them over.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, how long are these antibiotics, what kind of damage are we going to get? Be in the antibiotics for several weeks, months? We don't see the doctor for 3 months.
Yeah. That's kind of out of my realm.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, because pharmacology and all that, I've never really...
I'm just confused to take antibiotics, but... And acidophilus at the same time doesn't make sense.
I would say, can you get a phone call into Danny Vieira?
Yeah.
I think that would be the best way to go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sorry. Yeah. You're welcome.
Just on her topic, will natural antibiotics such as grape olive leaf extract and other, there's tons of natural antibiotics, Those won't destroy Acidophilus, will they?
To my understanding, no. They do not destroy the floral lining in the digestive tract.
Okay.
That's correct. Yeah.
Do you have any comments on the raw food craze?
Raw food craze, okay. Should I share the story? There's been a couple of times where we've tried to do more. I could do a whole separate thing on that, our experience. When we've had our restaurants, we always have people traveling through, and they'll come in and they'll announce almost to the whole restaurant that they are raw foodists. Like, okay, got it. You can eat these foods over here. And then they'd announce it again and again. And there's something about, I mean, I'm attracted to all these different things. I like to study them out. And I've tried to eat more and more raw foods. I think it's a good idea. There are some studies that show that some foods are better absorbed, slightly cooked or slightly steamed. Your grains have a difficult time being digested. I think, though, that's why I eat raw food, whole food, at the beginning of every meal whenever it's available. Eat as much as you can. Eat a lot of it. And I think as far as a craze, I think people can do really good on it. I think it's a great way to go. I think juicing can be a good thing. Again, but again, you don't want it to consume your life. I found that a lot of times whenever I started experimenting with these things, whether it was juicing or going raw, that it started consuming my life and it almost became like a religion to me. And I see that in other people. I mean, if you can handle that, but I'm just thinking that the more raw food, the more whole food we can eat, the better off we'll be. So does that answer your question? I think it's a good thing. And I think that really, I think if you could eat, you know, over 50 to 60% of your diet is raw, I think... For sure, do it. But again, chew your food thoroughly. You may have a more difficult time digesting some of the foods if you don't slightly steam them. Like I'm thinking tomatoes and broccoli and some of those foods like that. Sometimes they're a little bit better, more absorbed, slightly cooked or steamed. But we definitely overcook our food. In fact, I skipped maybe I'll go back to it now. I skipped over a slide because of time. But I put together, here's how I would think I made it sound like a government document number 6250. Hierarchy of food preparation. Here's the most nutrient-dense foods are raw foods, whole foods, and sprouted foods. The more of those we can eat and earlier in the meal. Also, there's what we call live enzymes in the foods that are not overcooked and overprocessed will actually help with your digestion. So there's a lot of benefits of eating more raw foods. I'm just concerned that sometimes we take it too far. Okay? The next thing would be to juice food and to consume it immediately that you juiced and hasn't had a lot of exposure to heat, light, and oxygen, okay? Then dehydrated and dry food, and then frozen food. You know, sometimes the best food in the supermarket is not in the produce aisle. A lot of times that's picked green and immature, and the nutrients haven't, and the whole plant hasn't matured yet. But you know what? When you take frozen food, typically that food was picked and frozen because it was so ripe that it couldn't be shipped without being damaged. So sometimes you can get a better deal financially and nutritionally by buying frozen food and eating the frozen food, okay, as opposed to eating the whole foods that were picked out of season or not quite ripe or gassed or whatever it was and steamed. The more processing, the more cooking and so forth and microwaving, I just think that we need to start staying away from all this microwave processed food. Slow down, enjoy the meal. Last 15 years, I just don't do microwave food. I'm not, you know, it's not a movement. I'm not on a mission. I just think the less we can use those types of foods and those types of equipment and things like that, I think the better off we'll be.
Is there any research that
validates? There's some research with what happens to the molecular structure of the food when you get to that high internal heat where there are different molecules that destroys the nutrient value of the food. It's a lot of the vegetable studies have been. Because it's such high heats and there's molecules rattling against each other in the microwave. And when you do those microwave high temperatures like that. A lot of, you know, heat is not, sometimes it's a good thing when it's steaming it. But when you go up to those high temperatures with the microwave, what it does to the molecular structure of the food and the nutrient value, it goes down. Again, that would be like advanced. This would be like 404. It's talking about microwaves and stuff like that. And I'm trying to give you the whole ball of wax, and it's really, I mean, that's very, you know, if you do a little microwaving, it's not a guilt trip, okay? But what I'd say is start using less of it and less of it, eating more nutrient-dense foods, whole foods would be best, and those types of things. Were you going to say something? Okay.
I would like to ask, because as Seventh-day Adventists, you know, we eat lots of soy products, and then there is lots of myth lately around, you know, soy milk and soy products. So I would like to know what is really true. It's hard to get truth, you know, on this product.
Are you talking in relationship to the estrogen?
Yes.
For men and things
yes.
like that? You would have to consume so much. It would be like some of those studies they did with saccharin, and where they injected mice with like about the equivalent of like 15 cases of soda pop in a day to get the amount of soy products, soy estrogens into your body to actually mess up the testosterone cycle and the hormones in the body. You'd have to eat so much of it, it would be almost be humanly impossible to do that. Okay, but again, once start thinking about it, yeah, a lot of times we use these foods as transition foods or substitute foods like tofu. A lot of them are still very processed foods. They were like 37. Look at right here. Tofu is down here. It's ranked 37. It's a good substitute, but again, it's not your main dish. Your whole foods, all these foods, these are the main foods you're eating, and you're eating smaller amounts of these over here. So soy foods are good. They're a good substitute. There's good nut products that are substitutes for making, you know, dairy-free cheeses and things like that. But again, it's not the main staple of the diet. Okay? James. Is it online too? It's online or at Lightbearer's office. You can pick up an article that Reese, James's wife, just wrote on soy products. And in relationship to the question here about messing with the hormone balance and so forth, especially with males, right? Okay. Is that good? Go to the Lightbearer's website or go to the resource office across the street in regard to soy. Okay. Question?
I am wondering if you know anything about Michael Clapper and fasting. I'm concerned for the brother and sister that have the parasites.
Okay. Michael Clapper, have you heard of the name? He's an anesthesiologist, physician, MD, who has been in this group called Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And he's does a lot with fasting?
Yes.
Okay, for parasite purposes.
I'm not sure if it's for parasites, but it sure helped me tremendously. I mean, I had chronic sinus problems since 1997, and finally I got to the point where I didn't care if I lived or died, and so I was never able to fast for over a day without, you know, at 1 o'clock or between 1 and 4, you know, going out to the fridge, and, you know. But I prayed about it, and it's just amazing what a fast can do. It cleared me up, and I felt so good.
All right.
I just was wondering if you knew anything about that and if it would help with...
I've heard of Michael Clapper, but I didn't realize he was into the advanced fasting and so forth in guidance.
Well, his CD, and I did start fasting before my friend Cindy Lou shared this CD with me, and you're supposed to, you know, be under his care
okay.
before you start it, because there are some people that are not supposed okay. to fast. But
okay.
That was an excellent, excellent...
Michael Clapper is a physician, started as an anesthesiologist, and then made the switch over to more supportive medicine. Clapper is K-L-A-P-E-R, if you want to look him up. K-L-A-P-E-R, Clapper. Question.
Yes. In the summer, I usually put up all my berries, freeze them for enough to last me until the next summer. And what I'm wondering, keeping it that long in a freezer, does it keep its food value?
You know what? The interesting thing is that basically the enzymes inside the berries go into a dormant stage when they're frozen. Okay? And same thing, you can store your nuts in the freezer. And they keep them, the nuts go into a dormant state. In fact, we've taken frozen nuts, bring them out and soak them, and they'll actually sprout. And so you can see that they're still, quotes, alive food. Still very active. So, yeah, you can keep them for a year like that, be fine.
And then another thing I noticed, the walnuts you had, they were clear over here.
Yeah.
And I take walnuts every day because they say it's good for the heart.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not saying that these foods over here are necessarily bad foods. They're just very nutrient dense. I'm sorry, they're very calorie dense. There are very omega-3 fatty acids in the walnuts. I'm going to get into a little bit of nutritionism on you now. If you want to get some omega-3 fatty acids, walnuts definitely are loaded. Good for the brain. Mm-hmm. Studies out of Loma Linda on the nuts, serving in nuts a day. Mm-hmm. And also
that's why they say the walnut even looks like the brain.
Exactly.
And say most of your foods that look like whatever you have in you are good for you. For
yeah,
that.
Exactly. And then the other thing is with the nut situation is they've shown a serving a day also thins the blood, makes the blood more viscous, okay, or less viscous, thinner, like a 10-weight oil as opposed to a 90-weight oil, thins your blood. It's a natural blood thinner, some of these nuts, with the omega-3s.
And then this is my last one. I have osteoporosis, and what I'm wondering, because I've been taking medication and stuff for it, and I'd like to get completely off of that, if I eat the kale and the collards and all that, I know that is very good for that, but I don't know for sure. I bought some. By the way, they have beautiful kale here.
For the kale in the garden here.
I steam some here, and that's what I've been eating at lunch every day. But can that be eaten raw, or is it better to cook it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It can be eaten raw, exactly. Now, there are some studies that show that if you're gonna cook it, don't cook it till it's very limp.
No, I just do a teeny bit of steaming, because they go...
Just touch it. Yeah,
it goes down in volume real fast.
Eat it raw. You can even eat it dry, dehydrated. Eat it dried. Okay? Some people like it. What's that? Liquid aminos and to dehydrate it. The kale. Little nutritional yeast and olive oil. We could have a cooking class here, couldn't we?
Okay, that was
a virtual cooking class.
What can you tell us about the GMO of how bad are our
GMO? You know, I don't even really want to go there. You know what I mean? I mean that's a whole. I mean, I don't think it's good. The bottom line.
How bad is it prevalent? How prevalent is it?
I think it's very prevalent, very widespread. Have you ever seen the documentary called Food Inc.? About the GMOs and the companies that are actually basically forcing everybody into a certain type of seed? Yeah. And you know what? The thing is, too, that I think a lot of times we also create a lot of stress for ourselves by, I mean, it's good to be into health and it's good. And I'm trying to stay away from the edges of being fanatical. Because if we stay in the middle and try to, you know, do the plant-based diet and do the best we can, and we don't get too hung up on whether this was a GMO or what was this spliced with and things like that, I think it's important, but I think that sometimes it gets us so off base and sometimes it alienates us from other people that we can't even actually reach out to other people. I've seen actually people that won't go to potlucks, they won't go to fellowship meals, and you can't really build, try to build a friendship over the meal, and I think if that's their stance, that's fine, but sometimes we sever relationships by drawing the lines on these things and becoming too extreme.
Well, if we pray and we do everything we know to be right, God will bless us.
Yeah, what's the scripture where Paul talks about where we'll actually eat poison and it won't harm us and things like that? And I don't think we should knowingly go around and experiment with poison. Okay? Do the best you can with what you have available and keep progressing. Okay?
Both Dr. Furman and Dr. McDougall seem to recommend low or no salt, and I'm just wondering what you had to say about that.
I think, you know, when I was single, I didn't have any salt in the house. And then we opened our restaurant, and my wife says, we have to get some salt in here. And I didn't do it because I spent out. I just didn't know. It wasn't in my, realm of thinking. You know, I think if there's an extreme situation, I think a lot of Furman and McDougall's patients are medically at risk. And so who's the most extreme out of all these physicians is Esselstein. No nuts.
No nuts.
No, because, yeah, and he was a cardiovascular surgeon. Yeah, and he recommends actually that extreme because remember, if you eat fat, even in nuts, what's going to happen? Your cholesterol is going to start being produced more in the liver. Okay? So depending upon your severity of situation would determine where I would go with the salt and with the nuts and those types of things. For the mainstream population, I think you need it. You know, as far as flavor, and also you need a little bit of electrolytes from the salt. So.
Esselstein also recommends pouring balsamic vinegar on everything.
Yeah. Okay. And again, exactly. And so really what you need to do is we use these different people and we take what we can from them and bring them into our repertoire. But we go back to the basics of what we have from the Bible and the spirit of prophecy as our basis. And if we can get some information or recipes from these different people, maybe bring us up to another level, then use their information. Okay? Comment?
I hear a lot about gluten sensitivity lately.
Yes.
Can you kind of go over that a bit?
Oh, my goodness. Gluten. Wheat-free, gluten-free, those types of things. I think it's very real. At first, when it was coming out, we had our health food store, and, you know, they're having, suddenly now nutritionism has hit that, too. You know, they have salsa, gluten-free, you know. Everything's gluten-free, you know. Paper, you know, gluten-free paper, you know. But I think it's very real, and it's really, it's the protein. Gluten is the protein in the wheat. And there's actually been some studies done that there's actually some types of, remember I talked about the queso morphines in the dairy? There's something, what's it called, Chloe? It's something, some kind of morphine-like substance in wheat, too. But what happens is that protein makes like a glue. And what I think the problem is that we've had so much wheat in our diet, in our ketchup, and our mustards, and it's overdose of it, and that we become insensitive to it. And then I think there's something to do with the GMO in the wheat, too. Something going on there as well. And so what we're having a hard time doing is digesting the gluten, the protein part of the wheat. And it's, in a sense, put it in a non-technical term, it's kind of like gumming up the system. And we're having a hard time. And I think basically we're just eating too much of it. And then some people have to get totally off it, or they'll have extreme headaches. They'll actually have emotional issues and different things like that. So I think it's very real. Okay, does that help? Does that answer the question? Okay.
I've just been doing this about 6 months, the veggie thing, and has there been any studies on how to clean your veggies before you take them, like that kills or neutralizes the pesticides?
You know, there's some different washes you can soak your vegetables in. Do some of you use those? There's a brand name. We had our health food store. We sold our last health food store 8 years ago, and so I'm kind of forgetting some of the names. There's a veggie wash brand that you can soak your vegetables in and wash them up before you eat them. A couple drops? White vinegar, hydrogen peroxide, few drops in there. Grapefruit seed extract. Few drops in your water to clean up the residues of the pesticides. Yeah, clean it up the best you can and enjoy them. Okay, does that help? So that's why it's fun to have a whole group here, all these teachers and professionals and health educators. I'll tell you what, should we wrap it up? You guys need it, yeah. Okay, I'll stick around for a while up here if you want to come up and ask some more questions or if you want to discuss some things. We'll come up and talk. We're going to wrap things up. One thing, last thing. One more thing. Food grade, you can get the food grade peroxide. It's like 4% or something rather than the 2%. Okay. Why don't we have a word of prayer and then we'll dismiss. Father, we thank you that you've made us so fearfully and wonderfully. And Father, we want to look at our bodies as temples of your Holy Spirit that can dwell in. And I pray, Father, that we can take these principles and apply them to our lives so they can be a blessing to us and our families, and that we can share them with other people so that they can clear up their minds and that they can see Jesus as clearly as we do. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.